Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. So today's episode is Mr. Jeff McManus. Jeff is the Director of Landscape Services at the University of Mississippi. He grows plants, he grows people, and he grows ideas. So listen, I'm sure you're thinking, why would a guy who's a landscape architect come on your show? Because he wrote a book, and he wrote a book that is really, I think, quite important because he does things, and it comes out in the interview, that a lot of people have a hard time doing. In terms of the variance of employees that he works with. And his theory is the grow theory, and it's create greatness, resilience, opportunity, and wisdom with your people, and they will grow and flourish in the organization. And you know, Jeff does that. And I gotta tell you, Jeff is just a really nice, nice man who has a ton of patience. And I just enjoy my time talking to him thoroughly. Quick little book update. I am now editing chapter 3 of the book, which is awesome. So it is just cruising. And I'll send it out to review to some colleagues of mine here shortly. And even better, the name has changed. I'll unveil that next week, just in time for me to go to New York City and film my half-hour commercial for the book, which is gonna be awesome. I wanna say thank you to my content partner, C-Suite Radio and Engage Me Online Magazine. And finally, I have a blog post coming out, I think later this week. So stay on the lookout for that. It's about Trump. See you. All right, Jeff, thank you so much for stopping by Executive After Hours. I almost said my old podcast name of Brave Endurance, which is no longer existent. So what I love to do with people who aren't, who are promoting something new, promoting a book like you're promoting, we'll talk about that in a sec, is I like to give my audience just a quick 10,000 foot view of who you are, what you do, and what your biggest and favorite color is. I have no idea. The last one's pointless, but who you are and what you do would be great.
Well, I'm Jeff McManus. I am living in Oxford, Mississippi, and I am the Director of Landscaping, Airport, and Golf Operations at the beautiful, most beautiful campus in the world of Ole Miss. So what I actually do, though, is I help connect students to this beautiful property within the first 2 or 3 minutes. And that's what I do.
So I think that's amazing because I have a lot of questions just about that. So one of the things, you're obviously someone who's in higher ed, and I was in the U.S. before I moved to the Middle East. There was grumblings from students and from parents specifically about, why do schools spend so much money on the landscape and the beautification of campus? Because at the end of the day, it ends up costing the students more money because you got to pay for it. So do you see this like dichotomous relationship between it looks pretty, but it's going to cost you more?
There's a give and take. There always is. But the worst is when you don't do it and you get the other complaints of, I don't want, and people quit coming and they say, well, we don't feel safe here. Nobody loves this place. We don't want to come. And so you've got to have a good balance. You don't go overboard and spend all this crazy amount. But at the same time, it's proven. There's just statistics out there that say that 62% of prospective students will decide in the first few minutes of a college visit based on appearance. And that's hard to argue with when that's out there, that people are making judgments, tens and thousands of dollars based on the way the campus feels and looks. So I get it. I mean, I pay tuition. I got 3 boys in college right now. I pay tuition. So, but I'm going to tell you, we're doing this thing really efficient. I mean, we run this thing like a small business in a way that We have fewer people on the front lines working in the field than we did 17 years ago, and we're doing way more than we used to. But it's all about efficiencies and getting people excited and passionate about what they do, so that bring that energy and that extra, you know, hump to get it all done. Mm-hmm. So that's more of a way I see it. Is it's a great investment. I would be scared not to invest in it.
So. I guess, you know, one of the questions I come up with when it comes to this topic is it's less about what you do. And that's kind of my tagline. It's not what you do, is who you are, because it's the bricks that made you who you are. And so how does someone, I was reading your bio and doing research, and I was like, how the hell does someone in landscape, first of all, get into landscape management? But then my wife was like, well, what's the connection to leadership? And we're going to get to that. So don't worry. Because I'm sure you get that question a lot. Like, what does one do with the other? But what I want to know is where are you originally from? I mean, you definitely are born and bred in the South. There's no doubt about that.
Well, thank you. Yes, that's correct. I was born outside of Atlanta, Georgia, in a little place. I grew up in Douglasville, Georgia. And so that's where my roots are. And then went to school at Auburn University, and then went down to Orlando for a while, and then Miami. That's where you get this Southern accent, is in Miami. So.
Really? No. So I'm always curious. All right, so I spent a summer in Atlanta. My mom and dad moved down there in 90... I want to say 4 or 5. And that's where my dad passed away, was in Atlanta. Mm. And so I spent summer down there after he passed away. And I was kind of, and I don't want to stereotype, so I'm going to say this in a way that's probably going to stereotype without intending to stereotype, is that I was taking some classes in the community college, and not to jump in off the deep end with a real serious topic, but like the racism was so blatant to me. Now, at least in the North, I always felt like maybe people tried to hide it a little bit, but like it was so blatant that I was really taken aback by some of the comments the students would make. And I kind of feel like, you know, I don't want to paint this broad brush that's all of the South, but like I would imagine you came across that a lot growing up, is this sense of racism and ignorance, I guess would be sometimes a better term.
Oh, I'm a firm believer that you tend to find what you look for. And we always looked at building stronger relationships and teams. Team sports were great because you had a bigger goal, something bigger than race. It was called winning. And you didn't care who carried the ball. You didn't care who was blocking, but you worked as a team. And I think team sports helped me more than anything to realize to focus on something greater, to focus on a bigger prize. And I think even today, if we can just accept all of us have gone through some bad things, some more than others and so forth. But then can that be used to help those around us and that next generation, that we can put them and lift them on our shoulders and do greater things. And let's don't tear each other down, but let's go to a greater cause. So
I think one of the things that I think it's fantastic, and I love hearing you say that, you know, one of the things that I've totally learned about, you know, I've been very lucky, right? I've lived in 4 countries. I lived in Australia, Japan, U.S. and like 4 major cities in the U.S. and then also now in the Middle East. And I think to your point, what you just said is that there is so much more that we have in common than differences. Yes. You know, I'm friends with Jews and Muslims, and I'm like, all right, I understand there's some history, but you guys still are really good people on both sides of the fence there. And, you know, and I'm friends with blacks and white. Like, so I always find like when you live around the world, you learn, it's like in the U.S. too, like you learn that you actually have way more in common than you do different. So don't focus on the differences. Focus on what you have in common, right?
Absolutely. Like, well, and if you don't watch the news, you find that you get along with people a lot better too. So, you know, because if it bleeds, it leads, right? I mean, they want drama. They want negativity. They want anything they can stir up to get people to watch. So if we take our lead from that, we're going to live in a really negative world in an area that we don't want to be in. But you're right. I mean, and the world is so much bigger. I mean, it's funny, growing up in the South, you thought racial relationships was black and white. And that's, I mean, you go down in the rest of the world, that's just a small part of it. I mean, there's all kind of different interesting cultures. So you're right. And people want to have, basically we all want the same thing. We want to have a good life, family life. Most of us want to be safe and be able to have opportunities. And that's what I'm about, you know,
is providing
opportunities.
That's so true. I mean, I'm not like a super religious guy, but like, I mean, like that is so true. We all want the same thing. So that gets me thinking about then like how you were raised in a family. So like how big was your family growing up?
I have an older brother, Craig, who's in the nursery business in Douglasville. He has a landscaping business. And then my sister, Janet, who's the middle child, she flies with Delta and she's out of based out of Atlanta. So, and then my parents were both school teachers or administrators in the school system there. So we, I guess a unit of five there. And then, then I have four boys now and my wife, Suzanne. So we're a unit of six.
I'm there with you too. So I have six. Yeah. I almost said I had six kids. No, I'm done. I had four. I was out. I tapped out at four. I was like, I can't do this anymore. So like growing up, like in your house with you, you're the youngest. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so how do you, you know, you have these parents who are educators, which clearly that education is at the center, I would imagine, of your upbringing.
Yeah.
So how has that helped you throughout your life, like this idea of learning and curiosity?
Oh, I mean, that's been one of the cornerstones. That and my faith have been the two cornerstones of growing and being where I am. But it's like when you don't know something, which is every day, you know how to go find out, right? When I moved to Miami, I didn't know any of the plant names. I didn't know any of the problems they were having. So I had to learn a whole new species. Everything was new. So I enrolled in community classes. I went and bought books, but it's all about teaching yourself. One of my professors says, you know, we didn't teach you everything when you were here, but we did teach you how to learn. And that's stuck with me everywhere I go. Even when I'm doing consulting work, it's all about learning and seeing what everyone else is doing.
You know, with that frame of mind, then how did you imbue that onto your kids?
I think modeling it was one. My dad modeled it for me, and I've tried to model it for them. And one was just to always be a learner in the car. I have what we call automobile university. Zig Ziglar used to call it, where you're listening all the time to something good, to something positive, to something that can help you. So I'm listening to books. I'm a big audiobook listener. I'm checking them out from Hoopla. I love Hoopla. And so, because they're free. And so I can check those books out and listen to them from our library. And that when they're in the truck with me, they're going to be listening to a book. And so reading, you know, I'm reading around the house. I'm modeling it. And then now I'm bribing them. I've been bribing them all their life. You know, if you'll read a book and I get to pick the book or you get to approve, you know, run it by me first and then write a one-page report on it, I'll pay you $50. I may have even gotten up to $100. Dr. Kelly, I can't. I only had two sons take me up on it twice, but that's, and I'm happy to pay that to get them in there. So
it sounds like your motto is kind of like knowledge is freedom, right? Like,
yeah. It's a good way to put it. I like that.
It's funny because like I'm a huge audiobook guy. Time is just never on my side, and whenever I open a book, I fall asleep within three pages. So so it takes me a year to read a 100-page book, and so I have this hack that I do. That you know, I'm in the middle of writing my book. First draft is due next week, and so
congratulations on that.
Thank you. Yes, you know it's a task. It's a task for sure. And so I started coming up with this hack that I started doing because it just made sense. So from a learning perspective, you learn by either seeing, doing, or hearing, whatever, right? And so I thought audiobook. Right. I'm hearing, and if you use at least with Kindle, you can do the audio while it's doing the visual at the same time. It highlights the words as you go. And so what I did is I thought, okay, Well, then I'm going to speed up the audio to 1.5 or 2 times the speed and read it as I'm listening to it at the same time. So I'm consuming a whole book in like half the time that it normally would take me. And you can stop and highlight it, and you can clip out the audio parts that you want to go back to and listen to again. And so I'm all about that because for me, it's efficient. And B, it's just, I just consume way faster in that way than reading. So I can appreciate
that. That's a great idea. I have not thought about that, but usually when I'm listening, I'm in the vehicle, so it's not good to follow along. But
yeah, I know it's exactly it.
I can see how you did it. That's a great way to do it.
Well, I always find that when I'm listening to it without reading, my mind starts to wander at some point. So you probably have a better level of focus than I do, but like my mind starts to kind of go off into left field. And I'm thinking
But don't you feel like, I mean, that has changed your life, that reading and listening has absolutely, and you won't be the same James Kelly tomorrow because of what you've read today, or even 5 years from now because of you'll have grown, don't you think?
I mean, I'd like to think so. I mean, I think that, it's funny, my wife and I just tried to do this. How long have you been married?
Don't ask me questions like that. Now, 22 years. Okay.
That's awesome. All right. So my wife and I just crossed the 10-year mark. And I said, let's do an inventory of 10 years. Cause I think, and tell me, like, do you find with your friends, and maybe not, cause we tend to be in a flock together, right? So you're probably in a faith-based flock of people who are similar interests and behaviors and things like that. But I find that, people blink. I'm sure this happens in your same community. And 10 years is over, blink again, 20 years are over, and you never really stop to assess how your relationship was with your partner. Like you just had kids and like you just ran to the finish line and the kids leave the house and you're like, all right, now what? Right? And you've got one more left at home, it sounds like. So like, you know.
Well, that's a couple. Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, that's right.
Suzanne and I had this conversation a couple of times. It's like, we will probably do something and make it fun to go somewhere just to talk again, just to learn to talk again, maybe even go to a conference or something. But and we get along great. But it's like, we've got that next season. You're right.
Yeah.
It's all right here.
That next season.
That next season where the boys are gone and, you know, we're empty nesters. It's 2 years away.
And so like, so yesterday we kind of had the conversation and she pointed out some of my, first of all, my wife is the, for me at least, the most positive person I know. Glasses always half full. If you don't have anything nice to say, don't say it. I grew up in a house where if you didn't have something nice to say, you said it anyway. So like it didn't really stop people. So I kind of grew up in a bit harsher environment than my wife. She grew up in a very Catholic loving family. And so in her polite, kind way, kind of unloaded on me yesterday. And so it was a bit of an ass kick for me. But the conclusion though, which I think is what I'm trying to get to, is that, and I said this to her, it's interesting in marriage because you have kids and as a married couple, if you're never putting your own selves in front of the kids in terms of, don't spend time getting to know each other throughout the marriage in that we want to get an activity to do together, not including the kids.
Yeah.
So, and not something like go to a movie because you don't talk, not go to dinner. I proposed golf. It's been a little bit of a pushback on that. She proposed crocheting, a little bit of a pushback on my side. but an activity that's not about being competitive, not about winning, but it's about supportive behavior with the other person. And just to put that in context, you know, my wife is a triathlete, triathlon coach. I used to do it. And so whenever we kind of go out for, when we did this, go out for run or cycling, the undertone was a bit competitive, whether we wanted to or not. So anyhow.
That's very wise. I think having that relationship where it is you and your wife sends a strong signal to the rest of the family, the kids, that you guys care about each other and you're strong. Because I heard it said once that the best thing that we can do for our kids is to love our spouse. And so that builds a lot of security in them, and knowing that mom and dad are they're okay. Then in general, they may be yelling at us right now, but in the big picture, we're going to be okay. So yeah. I like that.
Yeah. I think you missed the part where I told you that my wife chewed me out a little bit on the 10-year summary. So it was really quiet. Yeah. I was like, huh, he's being very stoked about this conversation. So tell me about how, you know, growing up in the South with these parents who are educators and a brother and sister, like, did you have a very close family knit? You know, is there the black sheep, or do you guys all get along?
Yeah, we all get along, enjoy one another. We're not together as much because we're spread out and busy with our families, but yeah, we enjoy getting together for family time, enjoy that. I don't know that we have a black sheep anymore. I think we're all pretty much have come back now.
Anymore, so, quote, anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, I was just kidding. How does someone, so your brother's obviously into horticulture, right? Mm-hmm. And you're into horticulture on a much grander scale, I guess. So, yes. So how did you go down this path of landscape architect?
Well, I'm glad you asked that, because I didn't start it that way. I was actually a marketing major. I think you're a marketing
yes,
guy.
Correct.
And so you may or may not appreciate this, but I was in a classroom of marketing people taking my first marketing class with 500 people. Oh. It was my first time that I had been in one of those college classes. And you know, you don't get to know any of the professors, and I just didn't build a relationship well with him. And I was so disconnected from the curriculum. I just wasn't tracking with it. And the questions made no sense. And so I didn't do well in the class, and I actually failed the class. So I had taken a horticultural class, I don't know, semester, either that same semester or before. And I really liked it, really enjoyed it, because I was going to work in my brother's garden center for the summer. And I figured, hey, I better know a few plant names. But you know, the professor that was in that class, he knew all the plant names. He knew everything about plants. But you know what really caught me, James, is that he knew my name. Dr. Harry Ponder knew my name, and he connected with me and every student there. And that really helped me have even a deeper passion for plants and that type of industry. And so I jumped in and dug in, so to speak, and then just really enjoyed that and finished out there and at Auburn. But that's, you know, it would cost me two more years. I was about I needed probably another a year or so to finish in business, and it's going to be another 2 years to get out of horticulture, but I'm so glad I did it.
So you have a business degree and a horticulture degree?
No, I didn't get I have enough credit hours for a minor in business, but okay, I don't right.
know. No, that's, so, yeah. So what is it about horticulture that attracts you? At least I mean, it's different now than probably what it was then, but is it because you grasped the concepts? Was it just the teacher?
More of a hands-on. You can see it at the end of the day. You know what you did. You can drive into a property today and over 12 hours, it just totally changed the way that site looks by what you do. And there's a lot of preparation in that, but there's a lot of gratification in that as well. Now, as I'm more in management and more leadership and more, it's growing the people who grow the plants. That's what really excites me is when I was managing large properties back in Miami, after about 3 or 4 years, I'm like, is this it? I mean, it's the same weeds in the same places. It's the same grass. It's the same shrubs. And it was like, I got to find something. It's either I got to go do something else, or I've got to find a more excitement in this. And that's where I started turning toward growing the people. Grow the people. And that took me on a deeper path of meaning and significance that I've truly enjoyed. And that's really where the book birthed from, is that passion to grow others.
So talk to me about that journey that you went on when you decided to kind of go into the management role. Were there insecurities that you had when you started going down that path?
Absolutely. I mean, I remember the first 6 months of getting out of college and running this beautiful property in Orlando at the Grand Cypress Resort. And I just, you know, I'm totally insecure, 24 years old. And this guy, Rick, who'd been 10 years my senior easily, was older than me and many years with the company. Everybody loved Rick, respected Rick. He was just a hardworking blue collar guy. And he asked me, and I was his manager, and he goes, "Jeff, how do you like this flower bed we just did?" I mean, it was gorgeous. It was huge, beautiful. And I just said, "You know, Rick, it looks good." But, you know, and I just went off and had a couple of other, you know, just minor things that needed to be fixed, but I was trying to be, you know, show that I was the manager, very insecure. And Rick looked at me, dropped all the tools in his hands, and he said, "I quit." And he turned and walked away. and inside, Dr. Kelly, I'm going, "Oh no.
Yeah, right? You know,
this number one guy, don't quit, Rick. Please come back." And I couldn't do that in front of everybody, so I just let him go. But I was fortunate enough that Rick and I had a conversation later. He cooled down and gotten some rest and everything. And he told me, he said, "Jeff, I just want you to know you're not aware of this, but your words matter." He goes, "This isn't the first time you've done this to us. Your comments just cut us." He goes, "We're here to do a good job for you. We're here to work hard." And my insecurities wouldn't let me appreciate them for what they were doing. I just felt like I had to build myself up. And the way I did that was to tear them down. Mm-hmm. That was such a humbling experience. But it's one that stuck with me, is that, you know, people care about what the leaders say. They want that appreciation. That's one of the highest motivators there is today, is that recognition and appreciation.
So, I mean, this is something I personally struggle with. So how do you give feedback without being critical, I guess? I don't know if that's the right phrase, but, you know, I mean, you have like the positive sandwich or whatever the hell it's called, where it's positive, negative,
right,
positive. But yeah. I mean, what if you struggle to find the positive and the negative? And positive, like, you know what I mean?
Well, not everybody needs a sandwich every time you see them. So if the only thing we're giving them is sandwiches all the time, I mean, we need to just be giving them sometimes just compliments. Mm-hmm. And so I'd say increase the number of times that we are recognizing the good, and mm-hmm. we need to see the good, because we may see, okay, this is out of alignment, this needs to happen, but at the same time they are doing some things well. But schedule those conversations when it gets to a point where you're having to have those uncomfortable conversations, then it's a circle back time, I think, and let's have this conversation tomorrow at 12 o'clock, so that they know it's coming. It's just not coming out of, you know, thin air, that we're just making this up.
Mm. So as you're kind of going through the leadership process and growing, what were some of the challenges that you found yourself having that were created by you or created by the environment?
I think all of us who are managing large, either companies or large properties, or have a lot on our plate, and you're trying to be successful, but at the same time, not break the budget. So you're looked at to do more. The companies and universities are constantly growing. There's bigger demands, and they're looking to you for solutions without having to have this huge budget increase. I find that as we add a new property or a new building, you know, the easy thing is to go out and say, "Well, we need this amount of money." And it's good that they know that, but at the same time, that may not happen. So we have to become creative. We have to become solution oriented, and be realistic that some of these things can't happen at a high level, but we can provide a good service at a medium level. And having those real expectation calls, I think that's what leads us through that process. What I do with that challenge is try to motivate our team. I have to have people who are fully engaged, who are passionate about what they do. And so what I do is I do a growth theory. G is for greatness. I want to make sure our staff knows that what they're doing is truly significant. It's great. So one of the ways we do that here is we make sure that they know that they're part of the recruiting process. They're helping recruit future lawyers and doctors who are going to go on and cure cancer and HIV. And when they do cure that, they had a small part in that. It's connecting the dots. You know, it's kind of like when John F. Kennedy went through NASA in 1962, he asked a janitor, what is it that you do here? And he says, I'm putting the man on the moon. You know, it's connecting the dots.
And so how do you make people care, right? So like, let's end this hypothetically in my head. I'm thinking, okay, I work for you. I work on the landscape. You know, typically, and correct me if I'm wrong, these are middle income laborers.
Middle to low income
laborers. Yeah.
I mean, it's entry level. It's pretty much entry level.
So how do you get them to care when they're in an environment where they're around people who are quote unquote bettering themselves, for lack of a better term, and you say, here's this doctor who's making gazillion dollars, you know, why should they care about the doctor, right? Because to your point, like if they're motivated and they're engaged, they're much more likely to do their job with gusto, to do it the best they can. But how do you get people in that position? Because that's a struggle globally. That's a struggle in many organizations when you have low to middle income individuals working a laborer's job to get them to care enough to do it right.
Right. Well, first of all, you have to look at your interview processes and who you bring into your culture. A culture trumps everything. Culture trumps strategic plans, culture trumps vision. I mean, the culture is key. And so I cultivate a culture like crazy. I'm always working on our culture. And that's and so when I hire people or we hire people, we make sure that we're finding people who are a good fit for the culture of they want to work. They want to be here. It is hard to get anybody who doesn't want to work to work. You can't make them. I mean, you can lead them. You can make them thirsty, but you can't make them drink, right? You can lead them right up to the water and you can get them thirsty, but they have to make the decision. And we're not always a good fit for everybody. We looked at people who were doing what we thought really well. We thought the military has some, you know, pretty gung-ho people who don't pay them a whole lot. We thought Disney did a great job, the Ritz-Carlton. We even thought Chick-fil-A with fast, quick service hiring, you know, a much entry-level more employee. And so we looked at companies like that to try to take away from them the nuggets of how they did what they did with what you're just saying. And a lot of that has to do with, first, I have to be passionate. I have to care about what I'm doing, the leader. And so I've got to model that. But then secondly, I've got to let them know it's important. I've got to communicate that. And if I don't communicate it, they never know. So one of the things we do is we create the very first day they're here, we have a class, 101, it's called The Vision. And we take them through The Vision class. It's a video that we've created here. And it's all these people talking on this video about how important their role is to the university. It's the football coach. It's the chancellor. It's mom and dads who are bringing their kids here. And you can go to our website. You can see this Vision video out there. It's all about creating that importance, their significance, their role. You see, you got to understand your role. You talk about we're not the college professors. They can have this university without us. They've got the professors, though. They need the professors because they got to teach the class. So we have to make sure everybody understands their role, just like playing back in sports. The quarterback may throw all the touchdowns, but if you don't have an offensive line, he can never complete that pass because they're blocking for him. And so we're strong in creating those roles, but then make that role important, make that role significant.
And so what you're trying to do there is really create shared core values.
Oh, brother, you're singing it now. Yes, because we do.
So then, yeah. So how do you get the weakest link to share those values? I mean, is it a little push, a little prod? Is it a little like, if you don't do it, get out? Is it, I'm not saying it'd be that direct maybe, but get on the boat, row the same direction or get off the boat. That's kind of what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. But you have to, I think everybody wants the same thing. You want to work with people who are excited. And if you're not excited, then this probably is not going to be a good fit for you. Mm-hmm. And so the way we do that is, one is we have a landscape creed that our team developed. So we're reviewing that creed weekly in our meetings, and we say the creed. So it incorporates our values, that core values that you were talking about. But then we also do things like a leader to leader class where we spend each time 1 hour each month where we talk about things that are important to us. We get to know each other and we build trust. We might invite a special speaker by DVD or YouTube, TEDx talk to come and talk to us. And then we'll just talk about it. It's been amazing to see how the collaboration has grown as we trust each other and we find out that we really want the same thing.
Do you find that because you do those activities, TED Talks, speakers, which is not the norm to give, you know what I mean? Like to give entry-level job employees who don't have a college education, some probably don't have a high school education, to give them the opportunity to listen to people. Basically, what I'm trying to say is you treat them like a human being that belongs in that culture by making them feel like they're a part of something bigger than just whacking a weed, mowing grass.
Well, they are. Yeah. My job is to connect the dots. That's right.
And so what I find really fascinating about that is that most people don't do that for that level of employee. Like they treat them like it's a transactional relationship, yeah, not a meaningful relationship.
Don't you find that sad though?
Oh, totally find it sad. Like I'm not, yeah. You know, it's very, this topic I really love because what you're really talking about is this concept that I talk about in my book called relatableness, which is different than relatedness. And it's the idea of the leader basically using relatableness as a verb. Your job is to go out, and as the leader, in my book, the authentic leader, your job is to go out with each one of your employees and find a way to create shared meaning with them in their life, whether it's about their dog, their kids, their wife, their hobbies. But in doing that, by creating that shared meaning, you're actually relating to them. And human nature wants to be relatable, right? They want relatedness in their life. Yes. They want to be part of something greater. And so,
that's right.
And so what you've done, which I think is just fascinating, is that in this little ecosystem at Ole Miss, right? Mm-hmm. On a grounds crew, which I guarantee you most students walk right by and not even think twice about it or who they are. You've got them to care enough about who they are in the ecosystem you've created to be active participants in the process. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I mean, it's about, I love your word picture there. That was great. I mean, you colored a great picture there of exactly the importance of their role and their, here's even where it goes even a little bit, where you might even enjoy it a little bit more, but we hire students to work with us. Mm-hmm. And we used to do a terrible job of getting them plugged in and making them feel, the students feel valued that work for us. And we gotta change this. And so I had to scratch my head and say, what's my role in this? And my role is I was not telling a very good story, Dr. Kelly. I wasn't telling a good story about these students. So I backed up and we started bringing in videos and things. And I started talking about who these students are and who they're going to become. And that changed the outlook of, you know, one day one of these students may come back and point to you, frontline worker, and say, it was you who had a huge impact in my life. And I stayed in school or I married the person I did, or I got involved in this organization, but it was because of your encouraging words, or it was something you said, the way you treated me like a person. And we hire a lot of guys. I mean, it's a very guy oriented. So we say, you treated me like a man or a woman. We hire women too, but you just have that mindset of that. And so we want our staff to see themselves as mentors. And that's where it gets really significant too, that they don't just see themselves as, okay, here's a college kid going to work for us for 12 weeks and then he's gone. But no, you're investing into their life. And let me tell you, when you get letters and you get dads calling you and telling you thank you for how your team invested in their son, man, I mean, that's a life changer. That's when you start, you know, you're going like, you're giving the fist pump in the air and you're going, yes, we're making deeper meaning. It's not just a paycheck. It's a purpose. We've got purpose here.
So then how, you know, we're discussing your kind of role in this environment, and I'm kind of basically trying to interweave your book a little bit in this as we're talking, by the way. Though it's not directly, I'm having kind of pick your brain, because I'm my guess is all these topics are in the book, right? So
that's right.
You know, one of the things that I think is really important, and I want to kind of get you to explain to me how you do this, is how are you cultivating greatness, right, in your organization with entry level? How are people moving up? Like, how do you cultivate this greatness? Are you saying something? Are you giving them resources? Are you being compassionate? Like, what are you doing as a leader? What do you recommend leaders to do to cultivate this greatness?
It, again, what you just said, all those we do, oh, that's as a leader, what I need to do is, if I've got to focus on the culture, I've got to cultivate the culture. And when I get my eye off the culture, then that's when things can get a little bit crazy. Excuse me. So I'm going to bring in and talk about it. Yes, I'm going to talk about all these significant things that we've talked about. But I'm also going to make sure that they're connecting with each other, that they see their role as important. But that greatness is how they do their work and why they do their work. Why is it? I mean, to feed your family is a very noble cause. To take care of them so you can live indoors and have food, all that's noble and grand. But is there even more that you're here to help our community, to help our small community by investing in someone else, even for 8 hours, in your excellence and how you do your work, but also how you treat each other? These men and women who work for me will talk to other men and women that I'll never get to have a positive influence with or have any influence. And they will change lives in their community. I knew we were hitting a home run when I had one of my guys in our leader-to-leader meeting goes, guys, this guy's a frontline operator, runs a weed eater most of the time, or an edger. And he goes, we're here for more than just to take up space in life. He goes, we may have more influence on these college kids than those college professors do in the classroom. And so I've asked several college professors that. I said, what do you think of that? And they've unanimously said, he's right. They probably do have more influence on them. And so I just
think... Why is that? I'm just curious. Like, why do you think that
they're
is?
They're working side by side. They're not
for the students in. Okay, sorry. The students that are working with you there.
Our student workers, yeah. Okay. And so they have an opportunity in the way they treat each other, even when they're interacting with students they don't work with, and how they respect them. Don't run heavy equipment while they're walking by, and that whole respect level of making good eye contact. Don't stare at women, beautiful girls are going by making them feel uncomfortable. You're a professional. That whole level of where we're supposed to be, and that treating each other with total respect. It's all about continually reinforcing that. I never stop. Every Monday morning we have our meeting, I show a video. And I'll pull hopefully a 2-minute video, something super short, to either encourage them in their personal growth, but I want them to think in that voice that they're talking to themselves, something positive, something. Mm-hmm. Today we just watched Mother Teresa. We watched a short 2-minute video of Mother Teresa, you know, and she had such a commitment to serve. Mm-hmm. And yet she did not have an army. She did not have a government, but she had tremendous influence in the world. Mm-hmm. And we made that parallel to our guys, you know, that you have a tremendous influence in this community. People watch you and admire you because of your work ethic and your excellence. You know, they've won 5 national championships here in beautification. So they have a great reputation, and they'll do things that nobody else can do in our society today, that they don't, people can't work in a 90-degree weather and do these hard things that they do. Make them know that what it is significant and important. Mm. I'm sorry. I may have strayed from your question. I just get excited.
No, that's all right. Listen, if you've noticed, there's not really a strict format. So like, just kind of go with it. Yeah. So what I want to do, because I only have you for a few more minutes here, is I have a segment, which you probably haven't heard because it's just new. And it's called Let's Get Authentic. I'm going to ask you 5 questions that I think gives insight to your authenticity as an individual. So are you ready to get authentic?
I'm ready.
All right, let's do it. Okay, question 1. You know, one of the big things that I think is important about authenticity is the ability to be self-aware. So what do you do to work on your self-awareness?
Ask for blind spots. Ask those who answer to me. It's one of the hardest things they do because they're vulnerable, but ask for blind spots. Try to do a 360 blind spot. I don't do it enough, but even my wife, and I only limit her to 1. I only give her 1 because I don't need too many.
Wise man. Wise man.
That's right. Yeah. That's been eye-opening. One of the best things is one of my bosses one time told me that I take things too personally. And I said, no, I don't. You know, so, but he was right.
I do not take them personally.
I do not. That's right. And he was one of my worst bosses I'd ever had in my career. But yet, he gave me some of the best insights. He was bold enough to tell me, and I've always been grateful for that. It really helped me in my career.
That's awesome. All right. Question 2. And in my head, I kind of know how this answer is going to go. But what role does integrity play in your job as a leader?
Well, one of our core values is lead by example. And I think of integrity. We talk about that in our workplace because we need to be able to trust each other. We work on a big campus. We don't watch each other. We don't see each other. And we got to know that we got each other's back, that I'm going to be doing things that I need to be doing, and they're going to be doing the things, so we don't have to check on each other and go back and redo things, get it right the first time. So that's huge for us and how we try to weave it into our culture. We don't talk about so much the word integrity as we do trust. Mm-hmm. Trust seems to be the speed of trust. When we trust each other, our speed of productivity goes way up. Mm-hmm. When we don't trust people, our productivity goes way down.
But I mean, trust is a derivative of integrity, right? So
yeah.
If someone follows through with what they say and they're honest and they're transparent, trust is an outcome of that, so to speak.
That's right.
All right, question 3. So I talked about, self-awareness, integrity. All right, question 3. How do you practice compassion as a leader?
It helps that I grew up doing this. My dad always had us out working and doing landscaping. So I know with the heat, but it's always to show compassion. I think I try to recognize, I don't do it probably as good as I should, but to recognize people for what they're doing, the benefit that they're contributing to the bigger picture, and try to keep that in front of them. I need to do a better job of that. But one of the things I asked our team one time was, what's the best way we can show you that we recognized? And multiple times I heard this was, you feed us. Keep feeding us. We love to be fed. That shows us that you appreciate us. So we're trying to do special lunches or ice cream or anything like that whenever we can for the guys.
Do you find, like, in my head, I'm thinking, because this is something I struggle with as well. It's just general compassion. Empathy, I'm pretty good, but compassion is a different level. Do you find that you find yourself sometimes second guessing your employees in the justification or reasons that they're giving you for problems that they're having?
I think I did much more in my early days. And we try to have a culture of not making excuses, but adapting and overcoming. So we try to hire people who are more solution oriented and not excuses. But if I start hearing excuses, then I start drilling down more to, or try to break down the barriers. So because we put mental barriers on ourselves all the time that why we can't do something. I can't finish the book because I'm too busy at work. Really? Is that really why? Is it because you're busy at work, or is it because you're too, and I'm talking to myself here, am I too unmotivated to finish it, you know? And so, you know, it took me 2 years to finish my book, and I was the only person to blame at that. So,
all right. Awesome. Question four, and you've talked about this a little bit already. You know, this idea to me of relatableness is really important for leaders, C-suite, executives, because if you can relate to the person on at the most simplistic common denominator, then you're creating a shared meaning. Are there any things that you do with your employees, your colleagues? I use the word colleagues a lot in my book versus like employees. Did you do with your colleagues to create shared meaning with them between your life and their life?
I think the closest I've come to being successful in that is having our leader-to-leader meetings where we pull small groups in once a month. And I'm committed to these multiple meetings with keeping them small, but we have these conversations where we get a little bit more casual, talk about things, open up, build a culture of trust. That's that, and then loading up people in a van and going to go visit another property, go see something, and you have that interaction and talking where you get to know each other. That's probably been the two things that stick out in my mind.
So are you kind of, you know, in my head, I feel like in America, we kind of have this traditional line of leader follower, right? So the leader will only get so close to you, and then, and then they have a different life. And, you know, one of the things that I kind of espouse is that if a leader shares a little bit about their life, their kids, their wife, not intimate details, but, you know, Johnny played football this weekend and Timmy hit a home run, and how did your son, you know, do this weekend in their sports? You know, I feel like sometimes there's this line in American business culture of like, those are two different worlds, don't cross them. Like work is work, personal is personal. Is that something you kind of subscribe to, just out of cultural normities? Word? I think that's a word. Yeah. I don't know.
I have to be honest. I mean, that's the norm. I mean, is you don't get into a lot of your personal. We deal with such drama at times that we just ask people to leave the personal things in the parking lot. And we try to come in professional. So I don't share a lot, although a lot of my staff follow me in social media, so they know, and I post. I'm pretty open, and I'm happy to share. And when we do leader to leader, I'll share, like when we share mistakes and things, I'll try to be honest and vulnerable and share some of my dumb things. And they have, the one thing I have to do though is I have to own a mistake. I mean, I have to own it, and that's helpful.
That's huge.
Yeah, because if you don't and you start throwing everybody under the bus, you just blow your trust. Nobody trusts you after that.
Well, and I feel like if a leader at any level in organization owns their mistake, I think there's an unwritten level of respect for most people that is given to the leader by saying, he owned it. Great. All right. Question five, we talked about this earlier as well. We've kind of interweaved my little segment throughout the conversation, but I think learning is really important. But there are two types of learning. There's the academic, social, like academic learning, whatever that is for you, like reading about horticulture, new trends in the field. And then there's personal learning. And so how do you use personal learning to help yourself be more self-aware, more compassionate, have better integrity, you know, be more relatable? Like, do you like almost like self-help learning to better yourself?
Well, Dr. Kelly, if you were in my office right now, you'd see two bookshelves side by side. The left one is full of horticulture. The right side is full of leadership development, self-help, those books. So when I get into personal, it's all about how to lead myself, lead others. What can I find to help others grow their greatness? How can I share this information? I have just been a student of leadership and leadership development and growing a culture of leadership. That's just in my, it's very nerdy, I guess, but it's just in my DNA.
It's not nerdy. You're going to do the job, right? And you want to be a leader. Yeah. You know, you probably should make sure you're doing it right or as best as you can. I don't think there's a right or wrong. I think it's the best you can. Well, thanks for doing Let's Get Authentic. I appreciate that. Yes. The last 5 minutes or so, you know, we've talked about the book kind of on and off throughout this whole entire conversation, kind of interweaved parts of the book. But I know there's the main concept of the book, right? The idea of, I just totally blanked out. I wrote it down. Grow? Tell me it's grow. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Do you want to share with me? I have two questions. So the first question is, why did you decide to write this book from where you're at in the position you're at in your life? And then two, let's unpack grow. So let's start with the first question.
There's a couple of reasons I wrote the book. I wrote it for myself at age 24 because I know the stumbling blocks that I hit and the things that I wished I'd have known. So I wrote it for myself to learn that next 24-year-old man or woman who takes on that leadership role has the book, a tool. I also wanted to honor my team. Although I don't get real personal in the book about the team, it's an honor for them. It's a tribute to all the teams that I've worked with over the last 25 years. So that's another reason that I wrote it. And when I do speaking, you know, people want something. And so I wanted to make sure I had something. I wanted to be diligent and not just leave them hanging. So I gave them something they could take home with them.
Hmm. Awesome. So then question two, obviously, is, and let's unpack. Yeah.
Grow is,
it's and this really, is the core concept of the book, right? That you kind of
unpack. It's the core concept, although I don't really talk about grow in detail. The book is based on these four principles. So it's about greatness, which is the G.
And so I just want to clear to my audience that, like, you know, this is the overpacking, the unpacking over 10 chapters, like as you write, as you write. Okay.
Yep. So if you wanted the book in four words, it would be greatness, resiliency, opportunity, and wisdom. That's G-R-O-W. And just real quick, the greatness, and we've talked a lot about that today, of people knowing their role, their significance, and how they play a bigger part. The resiliency is being able to, it's the leadership style of when you run up against problems, how do you solve them? And one of the ways that I'm really, really like to do is empower our team and to bring people around the table. It's not where I'm making the decision all the time. Although I may know the direction we want to go, I want ownership. I want people to buy in. So I've got to give them a seat at the table. So it builds resiliency. It builds that toughness where we can do these things together. And so then there's the opportunity. Every problem is an opportunity. And so we try to look at our challenges and situations like that. And then fourth is what we spend a lot of time in today is wisdom, is we try to expose our team to mentoring, to books, to videos. I've taken our staff down to the local library, showed them how to do things at the local library, get memberships and so forth. Okay. Then the O is opportunity, because every problem is an opportunity. And so we try to be positive in that, but we try to bring our team together and find solutions. And then wisdom is walking in wisdom. We talked a little bit about that today and how we try to get our team exposed to things of higher level thinking, better ways. So we bring in people, videos, books, and expose them to that. And I've even taken a group. I've taken our entire team down to the local library in small groups and showed them how to check out books, how to do all those type of things there, and use that as a resource. We're fine with our team growing so much that they even look for another opportunity outside of our workplace that may financially help them even more. We've had several people do that and grow beyond us. You know, if you want to be here and this is your passion, I want you to be here. There's nothing wrong. This is an honorable job, honorable work, and what we do is important. However, if you feel called to do something bigger and you want to do something or different, and we want to be your biggest cheerleader and help you do that. So don't get your college degree, which we've had several students come to work with us after they got their college degree and work with us full time. And don't settle on this as a job unless this is your passion. Mm-hmm. But we're fine with you staying here for a year or two until you get that next job. And we know that you'll add a lot of value to us, and we will for you. And we've had several students who've stayed with us for several years and then got a job in their major. And that's just been an awesome journey to see these folks explore and do that great things that they're doing.
Awesome. Thank you for that explanation. So it's my final question, and then I'm going to let you go before I lose my temper at the technology issue. for you, Jeff, you know, this is a really important question, I think, that we all ask ourselves. But how do you define happiness?
Happiness, I've heard this, and I truly believe it. It is a choice in so many ways that I need to decide. I mean, I sit there and think about all the problems I may have, and then I look at someone else like Mother Teresa who's doing, and I'm like, you know, I don't have problems. You know, I just don't have any. And then I have to choose to be happy, because negativity comes so easy. It's easy to gravitate down. And so it's work. Gravity's fighting against us to go up. So happiness to me has to be a daily choice. And that's, I think, one of the big reasons why I'm always reading, listening to audiobooks, is to keep that positive frame of mind and growing to get better.
Well, Jeff McManus, can you tell my audience where they can get your books? Just released, coming up next month, right? September?
Yeah. September is coming out on September 5th. And
that's my birthday.
Isn't it? Happy birthday early.
Thank you. Thank you.
I'm doing it on your birthday just to be that special day.
I appreciate the honor. It was really kind of you.
Yes. Well, if you Google Growing Weeders into Leaders, that's the name of the book, Growing Weeders into Leaders, or Jeff McManus, you'll find it. It's on Amazon. It's in all the bookstores. It's available, but it's on my website too. It's jeffmcmanusspeaking.com. So thank you for giving me a chance to be on your show.
All right. Well, have a lovely week.